Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today.
Serving spiritual seekers around the world. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome the author of a fascinating book that chronicles what we say when we're nearing death. It's entitled Words at the Threshold, and author Lisa Smart is a linguist, educator, and poet. She founded the Final Words Project, which is, this book is based on the findings that came out of that Final Words Project. And it's kind of an ongoing study devoted to collecting and interpreting the mysterious languages at the end of our lives, what we vocalize. She's also worked with seminal near-death and after-death researcher, Dr. Raymond Moody, who's been on my show previously, so that's cool. So it's a pleasure to welcome Lisa Smart to today's show. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know, you start the book with your own personal experience of this with your dad, don't you? And how that sort of influenced you a little bit. You want to talk about that?
Absolutely. My father and I, one thing that we shared is we loved language, and because of that, I became a linguist and studied language. And so 3 weeks before he died, and he began dying very unexpectedly, but as this process was happening, I noticed his language changed and that we weren't communicating in the ways we used to, and it was as if I entered almost another territory, almost another, where language was very different than what I was accustomed to when he and I had spoken for all my 53 years. And he suddenly started speaking a much more symbolic and metaphoric language, as if he were kind of in a dream. And he started speaking about angels, which completely blew me away, because my father was a hardcore skeptic and rationalist and materialist. So 10 days before he died, when he started looking in the corners of his room and told me about the angels he saw, I was very surprised. And I wrote down everything he said in those 3 weeks before he passed on, and I felt as if, as I mentioned earlier, I had entered into a territory I had never seen before, and the language was so varied and complex and rich, and that led me to want to understand it more.
Right, and the thing about the book is, you studied many folks who are making that transition, and there are it's a wide variety, of course, and various ways in which people speak and the images they use, but there is also a commonality, isn't there? There's, like you mentioned, angels. They show up, and they're not necessarily the angels that traditional angels from the Christian tradition, but they're definitely some kind of presence. But there's a multiplicity of imagery and things that can happen, and an interesting use of words. We'll talk about that in a little bit. There's also the lack of, it seems, a lack of seriousness. You know, it's almost whimsical and playful. And, you know, a lot of people fear dying, and they fear, well, you know, am I going to go to the bad place and everything? But there's very little in the book that you, in all your interviews with people and recording of people, where they're, you know, in terrible fear of the other side. And the only negative one, really, and I guess that wasn't necessarily negative, was where one of the folks was experiencing Men in Black, right? The dark, shadowy figures, and that was a little foreboding, wasn't it?
Yes, and, you know, I have to respond to what you're saying in part with sort of a disclaimer, because with this research, I invited people to share their accounts with me, and it probably is skewed a little bit towards the more positive accounts, because I think definitely there are stories that are more painful and more difficult, and you know, people, there are. So there is no doubt in my mind that we need to look more at the language of the threshold, because with my research, people who shared their accounts were people who, like me, were in awe of what they heard and saw, and oftentimes were very beautiful and transcendental experiences, and that's with the case with my father and me. But I also think, you know, there's a kind of resolution that can happen as people are dying, and through that process of making peace with the dying, that you see these kind of breakthroughs in transcendental awareness. But not everyone gets there, and there are also painful last words. But the majority of those that I received were really, as you said, had a sense of whimsicalness and lightheartedness.
Yeah, and in my experience as, you know, a minister for 30 years and witnessing a lot of people passing, there does seem to come that time where there's a sense of, it's not just resignation, it's a sense of peacefulness comes over some, and they know that it's okay, you know, I've come to terms with it. And that can be preceded by a lot of anguish sometimes, or not, but it always seems to shift. There's a shift, isn't there, in the days preceding. I've also come across a couple of people who just couldn't open themselves to that, you know, died in less than, you know, happy circumstances. But very few and far between, I think, compared to the general trends here.
Yes, that's been my experience through interviewing people and through the transcripts, and it's really great to hear your validation because you've had so much bedside experience. And I really got the sense it's as if our psyche is designed or programmed to go through the dying process and get to some point of breakthrough, because you know, we hear about the dreams of the dying and then the final words and the visitations people experience. I think it's over 70% of people have some kind of visitor comes, you know, a loved one or a friend or a figure of light come to them to take them away or at the end, right? So there really seems to be a way that we're designed, or, you know, or perhaps indeed we do move on to another dimension. But it very much seems integral to the dying process that there is this breakthrough that occurs, and the language tracks that.
Yeah, it's interesting. On the lighter side, you have a great quote from Bob Hope, right, when his wife said, "Bob, we never made arrangements for your burial. Where do you know, want to be buried, honey? We have to figure this out. What do you want? Where do you want to be buried?" And his response was, "Surprise me! Surprise me! I love it." Typical of Bob Hope, isn't it? But it's also, you know, when you reach that stage of release of the bodily form, you know, all the talk about what are you going to do with me is really immaterial, I think. I think people realize, you know, I'm going to a much more magnificent place. You can take care of all that stuff, you know. It's really not that important anymore. So I think there's an element of that to it. Also, you quote the very fascinating words of Roger Ebert's wife, right? He was a famous film critic, and he died, I don't know, a few years ago now. But can I read that passage? Because it is quite fascinating, I think. He said, "That week before Roger passed away, I would see him, and he would talk about having visited this other place. I thought he was hallucinating. I thought they were giving him too much medication. But the day before he passed away, he wrote me a note. And the note said, "This is all an elaborate hoax." I asked him, "What's a hoax?" And he was talking about this world, this place. He said it was all an illusion. I thought he was just confused, but he was not confused. He wasn't visiting heaven, not the way we think of heaven. He described it as a vastness that you can't even imagine. It was a place where the past, present, and future were happening all at once. I mean, I think that's a wonderful insight and breakthrough for him, because his words are corroborated by, you know, most of Eastern philosophy, for instance, you know, that talks about life as an illusion, right, and a vastness. It's very Buddhist in that sense. But I love the idea that it's a place where past, present, and future are happening all at once, because the universe seems to be, in my experience, built like that. You know, it's we have this appearance of time, but really we're in this infinite matrix or infinite whatever you want to call it, you know, this universal substance, which is oneness and all happening now. And we come from that. We go back to that. So that's really, in a sense, our true home, isn't it? The rest of it is a hoax in a way, almost made up by God, you know, to have fun or something.
Yes. And references to the illusion come up a fair amount in the transcripts, and not from, you know, when we, even Ebert was not necessarily a philosophical person. I mean, you hear these kinds of words from people who you consider pretty grounded, and they kind, as I said, I found them in several transcripts. And the other thing that's interesting to me in the language is people speak about space in very unusual ways. So, and it really seems to correspond to the near-death experience, where people describe coming out of their bodies. And in many of the transcripts, I heard things like, "I've got to go down there. I have to go down." So even though they're lying in bed, they're having this experience of being up in space. Or, "I'm on top now, moving on top." Or, "I'm crossing up, I'm crossing up."
Mm-hmm.
So there are these references that definitely space and time seem to shift in very real ways for people as they cross the threshold.
And so for a devil's advocate here, if we say, "Oh, well, this is all, you know, generated in the brain. Mm-hmm. This is the brain getting used to this idea of annihilation. You know, I'm going to, into the nothingness." I guess that's okay, right? We don't have to posit that there must be an afterlife or a continuity of souls, though, you know, many people think that that makes sense when they, you know, read all these stories about near-death experiences and the commonality of, you know, what's seen there. It seems like there's some kind of continuity.
Yes, the way I think of it is there's just too much that I've seen in the language that, to me, indicates that there's something continuing. You know, I have no idea what it is. But, for example, there's terminal lucidity, where someone may be in a coma literally for years, and right before that person dies may come out to say words of reconciliation or love or forgiveness, and then go back into the coma and die. You know, these flashes of lucidity, and always during those times, people share words of guidance or love. So you have something like terminal lucidity. You have conversations with deceased loved ones. And I just can't imagine, when you see how common. You know, I could imagine if there were one or two cases, and I might say, it's just the meds, just strange hallucinations. But when you see patterns and the kinds of experiences people are having, where you think of someone, one person who is in a, who participated, his mother, her brain, when they looked at it, was like completely gone. I mean, essentially all its function had gone. And 3 days before she died, she came out of a coma and told her son where all the files were left in her study.
Wow.
Yeah. And so is that just a fluke? I don't know. It's very hard for me to believe that it's just a sheer crazy accident, because there are too many cases through my research of consciousness persisting, terminal lucidity is one example. Another example for me is something I call sustained narratives, where someone maybe on December 1st starts telling kind of a metaphor of travel, which is very common. You know, might start saying, well, I'm getting ready for the trip. And then December 4th, they'll start talking about, where's the train? I need the train. And then a few days later, may start talking about how it's moving from the platform, but there are some mechanical difficulties. And over days or even weeks, this narrative continues until finally, you know, they may say, okay, I'm ready to go now. You know, I'm getting ready to leave. And how can the mind, how can a, quote, damaged brain track this kind of narrative over time? That just means to me that there's some kind of meta-consciousness, like a dream, like very active dream state. And we know that when people are in REM dream, you know, activity, their brains are very active as it is when we're in waking states. So even if we were to say these are just dreams, well, that's remarkable in itself, because how is it that the mind's that active?
Right, exactly.
So close to dying. So, and I walked into this research, you know, I would say I was a relatively spiritual person, but I was on the fence, because I've always been very analytical myself, and this research has really been very, if there's such a way to say I've been convinced, I don't know, but I just have much more of my disbelief has been suspended as I look at the data. And, you know, we now have like 10,000 2,000 utterances, and they're all falling into these patterns of speaking of travel, having visitors in the room, sustained narratives. I mean, all these things are appearing with great frequency. So it's hard to deny the data.
Yes, agreed. And another thing that seems to me that common is the, you mentioned people rallying, you know, and becoming lucid, mm-hmm. and that, I've seen that many, many times. But also they will wait around for, say, a loved one to arrive. You know, if there's a member of the family who hasn't quite got there yet, they'll stay alive until that person's there. And whenever everybody's gathered and there's a completeness, then they can go. So even if they're in a coma, and this with my late wife, you know, that she waited until the final family member was there before she could go on. So obviously, there's, like you said, there's some kind of meta consciousness there that's aware, you know, even though she was totally out of it and wasn't cognizant in normal rational terms, but she was still, you know, had that knowledge somewhere in consciousness. I mean, I was convinced of that going through that situation. It happened also with my late mother-in-law. She rallied when I got there, you know, and had been unresponsive, and yet when we got there, she opened her eyes and smiled and grabbed held on to me tightly, and then went back into the coma. And you know, she obviously was saying, "I recognize you. I'm glad you're here." And it was very subtle. You could have missed it if you weren't paying attention. You know, that's another thing about this, isn't it? We have to be attuned. One thing before we go to the break, I just want to point out for listeners, in this book, there's a checklist here of if someone you love is dying, what's some suggestions for how to approach that, and we can go into more detail if you want. But I think they're very sensible. First of all, is enter the world of your beloved. You know, it's not about you, it's about them. We spend a lot of time bemoaning our own sadness, and we need, and that's okay too. But I think we have to allow, you know, it's about them. You know, we're trying to help them across. Have eyes for the sacred. You know, be looking for these clues at a deeper level. Validate your loved ones' words and experiences, because sometimes we think, oh well, they've lost it, they're hallucinating, whatever. We don't pay attention to it, which is sad. Be a student of the language, you know, really work out what they're saying beyond the seeming nonsense. Ask questions with authenticity and curiosity, you know, stay open. And then assume your loved one can hear you even when unresponsive or quiet. Let the dying person know how deep your love goes. And I think this is huge, you know, for us to say, we love you, and we know that you love us, and you know, all is well in that regard. And then the last one you add is savor silence. Sometimes we're so afraid, you know, we just can't be quiet. We've got to keep up the dialogue, you know, with others, and et cetera, or it's saying, oh, it's going to be okay, don't worry, and all that. It's okay to feel what you feel, right? And to just let that be. And I think those are all very wise approaches to dealing with someone who's passing, you know?
Yes.
You'll find...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, these are the things that I saw really worked for people as they were sitting bedside with their loved ones. And as
yes.
Language.
Yes. Well, very good. Folks, I'm with Lisa Smart. We're talking about her very fascinating book. It's called Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We Are Nearing Death. This isn't morbid, by the way. This is fascinating and helpful for our loved ones who are passing over, and also for ourselves, because it brings meaning to life, even in those transition moments. When we come back, we'll find out more about the metaphors and the dreams and the seemingly nonsensical words that can have lots of meaning. Join us in 2 minutes after these messages from Unity.
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727 from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
The benefits of spiritually conscious living start now. For a time-tested method to live with purpose and release your infinite potential, tune in to the Yoga Hour, Living the Eternal Way, with Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Pacific, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Lisa Smart. We're talking about her book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And much of what we say when we're nearing death is kind of ineffable, because the subject matter is ineffable, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's difficult to get a heads around it. It's mysterious. It's paradoxical. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a lot of the words that are used are sort of metaphorical, because that's the only way we can approach these realms. It's like when, if you've been meditating for a while, you're into an inner landscape, but it's hard to define it or even put words around it. And I think it's the same here. We're into this other dimension, and it's beyond what we're used to describing. And some people say, oh, well, it's just nonsense coming out of these people's mouths. And, you know, because maybe they're over-medicated or they're losing it, they're not so mentally aware. But it's not just that, is it? It's a struggle, I think, just to convey something meaningful, right? That's what's going on to a degree.
I do think that's what's going on, and I think people have entered almost a dreamlike state, and they can only talk about it in metaphors, as you mentioned. And some of the first thing that we discovered about metaphors, and this was also written about in another book, and we just confirmed their findings, that Maggie Callahan and Patricia Kelly's book, Final Gifts, is also really a lovely look by two hospices at this metaphorical language. But what we found is that people have these signature metaphors. So, for example, Jeffrey Holder, who was a dancer and choreographer, his very last words were, arms 2-3, turn 2-3, swing 2-3, down 2-3. So he used, as he was dying and he talked about entering and crossing the threshold, he used the symbols of being a dancer, right? However, someone else whose father was a contractor, a roofing contractor, he said these words. He would awaken and look over at me and smile so big. And he told me, they have all these kitchenettes over there. There were miles and miles of them, and he would be helping to build them. So for her father, the reality that he encountered, the way he explained it, was a world with kitchenettes that needed remodeling. And it's the symbols of his experience or the metaphors he used or just the symbols he saw before him were closely connected to his life experience.
And right.
People talk a lot about taking a trip. I mean, this is one of the most common metaphors that appear at an end of life. And the types and modes of transportation also seem to be closely connected to who people are. So my dad was a gambler, and he was talking about taking the oxygen tent to Las Vegas. He's getting ready. Don't forget to bring the oxygen tank because we're going to Las Vegas. We're going to Las Vegas. And so he was talking about a trip, you know, for the great gambler. People talk a lot about the passport. The image of passport emerges a lot in people's conversations. Yellow bus, there's the bus. Who's driving that bus, Grandma? Not sure, but lots of angels. So isn't that just beautiful metaphors of travel? And one of the things I'm so curious about, and I hope to begin to investigate in the next year or two, is do we see these metaphors of travel in other languages? Are we going to find this in Russian, French, in other languages? Are people speaking about the dying process in terms of a journey and in terms of travel?
And, right.
You know, so but many times, if people listen out for these metaphors of travel, sometimes you'll hear them speak over a period of days or weeks using the same metaphor, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the train is pulling out of the station, something's wrong with the train, I need help with the train. But if you're not tracking the language, it just seems on a day-to-day, if you just catch it in snatches, it seems like pure nonsense. And yet what's so remarkable is if you write down the words and track them, oftentimes there's a kind of unity in the language and the metaphors and in the stories and the narratives that, again, suggests to me that at least, if nothing else, consciousness is outside of our brains. And we also know that people, as they're dying, oftentimes announce some kind of big occasion, like some big occasion is approaching. My dad talked about the big art show, which was a metaphor very closely connected to his life with my mother because she was an artist. And he would often carry her boxes to the art show. So he talked about bringing boxes to the big art exhibition that was approaching. And that art exhibition, that big event, really, really was a metaphor for this event that was to approach in, about 3 weeks when he passed on. So it's really fascinating how we have these symbols of our lives. You know, we have these narratives. We are who we are. And we bring those with us often to the threshold as we speak about this ineffable experience. So metaphor is definitely one of the characteristics in the language of end of life.
Right. And we in Unity, we say that we create our own reality, you know, mm-hmm. literally. And then so it would be normal then for us to see things through the lens of our own mm-hmm. perception, right? So, you know, whatever's it most dear to us, that's the way we're going to outpicture this universal whatever it is beyond in this afterlife. And I think that's why they say, you know, people who are Buddhists, you know, have the Buddha come to them. If people yeah. are Christian, have Jesus or whatever. If you're an atheist, you may have something else. But so it's whatever's culturally significant for you that's the way you're going to frame it and see it. And I think that's fine. But we have to remember that those images all point to the image beyond it. You know, it's like D.H. Yeah. Lawrence said, behind the sun is the dark sun. And, you know, there's the imagery of the sun, but then there's also this mystery beyond, if you like. And we put ideas to, you know, the Buddhists, the Tibetan Buddhists, of course, are very, you know, they're the experts on this, going into the bardo, you know, the between times mm-hmm. after death and, you know, helping people across. And they've written, you know, many books on it, of course, Tibetan Book of the Dead being, you know, one of them. And this is fascinating, too, because, again, it corroborates a lot of what you're finding, you know, that what we expect to find, we usually find. And where we've been, I think, in the rest of our life is where we're going to go. For instance, if we're, you know, a fearful, hateful person, you know, it's not going to be so friendly on the other side. If we're a loving, open person, then, you know, it's warm and wonderful and beautiful. So, therefore, we have to spend the time wisely here, right? Because if we want to have a good experience after our lives, then have a good experience here. You know, if it's filled with anger and hate and fear, and it's, you know, you're probably going to have more of that. So we don't want to do that to ourselves.
Yes, it's so true. And one story I love, can I read you a couple of paragraphs? Because this is one story of someone who just at the moment of death seemed to have a transformational moment. You know, as you were saying, people were hateful or angry. They often bring that within the threshold, but also we see moments of breakthrough. And I love this story from one of the participants. More than once, his father had quoted these lines from Invictus by William Ernest Henley. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. After a catastrophic heart attack, followed by a week of treatments with no improvement, his father, in the hours before dawn, asked the nurses to pull the plug. They did, and then called Jeffrey and his two brothers to let them know their father would soon be dying. As they gathered at their father's side, he somehow managed to hoist himself up to a sitting position and quoted the words Jeffrey had come to know so well. So throughout Jeffrey's life, his father would be very judgmental whenever he expressed a moment of weakness or vulnerability. His father would say to his son, remember, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. But right then, at that moment he died, he repeated those words, and then he looked at his sons and said, ah, bullshit. And at that very moment, the threshold, Jeffrey said he liked to think of himself as a powerful padrone, but before death, he was physically humbled. And as the fortress of his heart crumbled, he felt his complete powerlessness in the face of the big mystery.
Right, the moment of surrender, wasn't that really?
Yeah.
You know, and we fear surrender, you know, when you be in charge all the time. And that's a wonderful poem. You know, there's times in our lives when we need to say, yeah. you know, I'm in charge, I can do it. But ultimately we realize, you know, we don't do it. It's the spirit within us that does it. And eventually we have to relax into that. And I think that's the conundrum, isn't it, being alive? You know, it's all about us, and yet it's not about us at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
Don't take it personally, but, it's all about you, but don't take it personally. And get our heads around that one is difficult sometimes.
Yeah, one of the greatest gifts that I received from my father's passing, he was someone who was very, very controlling and controlled through his mind and intellect. He was very bright, and he was able to do that. And as he entered the dying process, I could watch him surrender into something I had never seen him surrender into. And as I remember several times I would say, "Papa, how you doing?" And he would say, "I'm working on myself. I'm working on myself."
Oh, wow.
And I really believe that there is this way that this the mind that had always sort of guided him and structured his life was giving way to another kind of way of being as he was entering. Really, as I stood, you know, unlike you, I had never been bedside with anyone who died. So this was really very new to me to go through this whole process so closely. And it was such a gift to watch someone who is so afraid of dying and who is so bent on control his whole life just move beautifully into surrender. And then I would watch his language, which was also so heavily controlled by his intellect. He was so bright. Suddenly fall into metaphors. Right, a couple days before he died, he turned to his secretary and said, "Alice, this is very interesting. I've never done this before."
Right.
And it just, I remember hearing those words, and it was those phrases were a big motivation behind my doing this research, because I thought, what is this? You know, what is this that my father, who his whole life was terrified of experiencing, is suddenly now very interesting, right, and fascinating. And I was very intrigued by that. And the non-referential language, where he said that this is very common in the language of the dying, where people refer to an "it" like, "It's very beautiful over there," or "Too bad,
yeah,
you know, can't tell you, too bad I can't tell you about all of this."
Yes, absolutely.
A real sense of mystery.
You know, when my first wife died of breast cancer, she was, you know, in the hospital for 6 days in a coma, and
oh, wow.
And when she passed, I needed to go to the restroom real bad, so I went to the restroom, and as I was in the restroom, she spoke to me, you know, and it wasn't in words that I could hear, but it was in that internal dialogue that you reference in the book, actually, and she said, oh, it's so wonderful here. It's so beautiful. And then at that very moment, I saw this image of this huge, huge meadow, and it was filled with flowers, you know. And I thought, how did that all happen? You know, was I just creating that in my mind? But, you know, I was doing some very humdrum thing, and I was in a bathroom, and and yet there was this amazing, and I mean, I knew it to be true beyond a shadow of a doubt. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't like,
yeah,
I'm wish fulfilling this. And to me, it was, what, you know, a wonderful blessing that she was actually speaking to me in those moments. You know, after she'd gone physically, she was still there. And I think this is, you know, one of the aspects of what you talk about in the book. Sometimes they come, you know, and ring bells, don't they, or snatches of music. You tell one where somebody actually left a text message, right?
Yes.
Which is quite fascinating. So there's different ways that the dead try and break through to us and leave messages for us.
Yes, this was one of the things that surprised me most, because I'm, you know, trained as a linguist. You write down what you hear in terms of spoken language, right? And my idea of language was something that was spoken. That's what I was trained in. That was my filter. And what surprised me is how many people, and even people, again, I would not think of as being particularly interested in psychic phenomena or, you know, being spiritually oriented, how many people expressed to me this kind of telepathic communication, Raymond Moody calls it a shared death experience, that there are so many people describe how as their loved ones are dying and crossing the threshold, they will see, just like you said, meadows, or feel a vortex, you know, the experience that something is very different in the room, or see mist going up in the air, and then get something like a text message, or, you know, just what you said, bells. And it really, for me, expanded my definition of what language is. And what I saw is that in my training, I just thought language was at one level, right? Just one thing. And the language of the threshold is multi-level. There's so many types of communication and language going on, and it's so blessed and important to be open to them. And I had a shared death experience with my father, I guess it was about 7 days before he died, where I was 70 miles away. He was in Berkeley, and I was in Napa, California. And I woke up at 3:15 in the morning. I looked at the clock, and I could see the red, you know, the red numbers. And it was at 3:15 flashing. And I turned to my husband, and I said, there's such a sense of presence in the room. The room feels full. You know how you know someone else is in the room with you,
mm-hmm.
you know, when the lights are out? And I said, I feel like there are people crowding the room. You know, my husband and just said, oh, honey, go back to sleep, go back to sleep. And I said, I wonder if my father is passing now, because I feel something very unique going on. And again, he said, honey, go back to sleep, go back to sleep. So I went back to sleep, and the next day I went and visited my parents after work, and I asked my mom, you know, how's Dad doing? And she said, he's doing okay, but, you know, the strangest thing happened. At 3:15 in the morning, he woke up and started talking about how crowded the room was. And he said to me, I don't know. I don't have time to speak with all these people. I just can't speak. There are so many people here. And just as you had described with your wife, and you had, it seems like you entered into some kind of reality or dimension with her, right, in terms of seeing the meadow and so forth. It seems like I had entered into that crowded room with my father. And as you had mentioned before, space and time were completely suspended. And
yes.
As I've interviewed and spoken, you know, with Raymond and then William Peters in Santa Barbara, who runs the Shared Crossings Project, and he's done a lot of research with people's shared death experiences, many people now are sharing accounts, and the less people feel afraid, the more they can open up to kind of as the portal widens and really have some very remarkable experiences. Of course, losing someone we love is deeply painful. Of course, death can have some very ugly moments, but at the same time, as the portal opens, it really seems to invite us into it. And I noticed that people who would transcribe their loved one's final words, or at least enter into the language of their loved one, it helped them kind of enter into their loved one's reality also. And many times that made for closer connections, but also some really powerful transcendental moments, you know, transpersonal moments.
Let me ask you about one experience I had about a week after my first wife died. And I'd gone up to Seattle to be with a friend just to get away. And it was late at night. It must have been 2 or 3 in the morning. But I hadn't gone to sleep. I was up listening to music and then turned the music off. And I could distinctly hear my wife crying. And it seemed like from a long distance away, but it was also very present, you know. But it wasn't on this dimension. It wasn't just in my head either. And it was quite upsetting because, you know, I thought I didn't want it to be upset or unhappy. But I've always wondered what had happened there. And then a few weeks later, her mother, we were visiting her, and she said she heard the same crying in the night. I just put that down to the idea that she, you know, although she'd gone over to the other side, she still felt regret because she was relatively young. You know, this wasn't expected that she would die like this, as for so many people who die of breast cancer. I know it's a very sad thing for many of us. But what do you think was going on there?
My sense is that we are soul beings, and we have many dimensions. I shouldn't use the word dimensions, but facets to who we are. And I think that when we leave this planet on one, or this dimension, I should say, I think on one hand there is that joy and release of going on But I think there's also a letting go and a sadness. And I think everyone is in a different state of readiness when we go. I mean, I think, and that's part of who we are as souls, is how we decide to leave this world. But you both heard her, and I'm imagining in my heart you both sent her love, and I think that's all she needed, right?
Right.
But I remember my father. I haven't mentioned this to anyone during an interview, but after my father died, about 2 days later, my dad, we had a close relationship, but a tempestuous one. And I remember one day I was just dancing, because dance is the way I handle my feelings. It's like my outlet. And I was dancing, and I could feel him looking down at me. And I could feel and hear him sort of say, "I'm sorry I never got what your dance was. I'm sorry I never acknowledged the dancer in you." It was just, I could just feel that, and I could feel his regret and his sadness. And I think that's real. I think my feeling is as people are moving to wherever we go, it's the unraveling of the threads that connect us here. And I've heard so many stories of automatic writing, of hearing these kinds of communications. And again, it seems the universe often is designed for us to find healing and resolution when we can have an open heart and open ear for it. And that's what's been one of the gifts of doing this research for me, is to see that and to see how the possibility for healing is so, so present always.
You know, my daughter believes that every time she, a butterfly is close or alights near her or on her, that's her mom, And yeah. And the last time we were at the bench, we created a memorial to my wife on the river in Fort Worth. A butterfly came and landed on, initially on my daughter, and then on my glasses, and walked with us, for about a mile, and only let go when we got to the bench. And and it was like, whoa, how's that happen? And people, say, "Oh, well, that's silly, how can that butterfly be, in any way connected?" But the way I look at it is there's no time or space, right, in the dimension beyond, concrete reality. And so whenever we tune into that person, whenever we're thinking of them, some aspect of them is drawn to us at that point, and they can move into anything that's available to send that message to us, so they could move into that butterfly for that moment, or they can ring that bell or whatever it is, that there's a correspondence of energy, if you like, brings. So it doesn't mean their soul is there. It means that their resonance is still attuned to us, right? And so they can be there for that moment with us. It's very subtle and beautiful in a way. It's beyond sort of souls flitting around in heaven. It's much more beautiful than that, if you like.
Yeah. I love your description. I've never heard it described that way, and it's very beautiful and very accessible. Yeah, and it does. When we think about sort of the language or the communication of spirit, there are different ways that spirit seems to emerge, and synchronicity. And birds and butterflies are one of the most common ways that those synchronicities occur. And, my father, right, a few weeks also after my mother died, I started getting these poems, and I just started writing them down, and many of them were beautiful. And they were really, he asked me to give them to my mother for comfort. And at first, the skeptic in my mind was like, "What is this? Oh, I'm just making this up, blah, 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 blah." And I just decided, what's it going to hurt for me to just let my hand go loose and write down what comes through? And we think about great artists and the idea of the muse. And, a lot of great artists, as well as great mystics, just open themselves up. Again, that whole idea of suspending disbelief to whatever comes through and allowing it to happen. And that's true with after-death communication, also communication, at the threshold. Because as we mentioned you know, at the end of life, sometimes the language will get very nonsensical. You know, we'll hear things like, yes, I'd like scrambled eggs, but where would you reappear? Or, like my dad said, tell Jack my modality is broken. And, you know, it's language, it's communication that is different than the way we are used to receiving it. And yet there are ways to enter into it. And we know that when people have a near-death experience, there's that whole thing about it being ineffable. But also people come back with this very paradoxical language. People will say something like, oh, I've never felt as alive as when I was dead, right? You know, they die, they come back. Well, that's a complete paradox. That makes no sense, right?
Right. Yeah.
Or it felt like a minute, but it also felt like an eternity. And it seems that in the other dimension or in those other realms, that two things can exist at one time, right? That kind of paradoxical experience is possible, that literal language tells us, you know, if I say to you, pass me the cup, right? There's only one reality, a one-to-one correspondence. But it seems in the language of the threshold and even in the language of spirit that, you know, for you, spirit may emerge as a butterfly. For me, it might emerge in the symbol of an apple, right? Or that there are multiple meanings and multiple symbols for things. When we had spoken earlier about, Buddha showing up or, you know, different figures showing up for the same kind of meaning or consciousness, you think about that's language. I mean, there's this thing called an apple. And in all these different languages, people describe an apple in a very different way, right? Manzana in Spanish or, you know, there's different ways, but it's still an apple. And one of the things I've noticed in interviewing people is that when spirit communicates, oftentimes spirit communicates in very nonsensical ways, through images and symbols, and has multiple various meanings. So when I interviewed psychics, they shared with me, many of them, that when they get a nonsensical image, they knew that it was really pure communication from spirit, because those are the symbols they trusted, that the ones that were more mysterious and paradoxical. And I spoke with one psychic, and he explained to me that over the years he's done readings, he actually had what he called a spiritual iconography. He would have these really unusual symbols that consistently meant certain things when he gave readings. So, for example, when he got the image of a light, a burner on a stove, that would represent that someone had Alzheimer's or there was someone in the family with Alzheimer's. Well, that's a completely nonsensical correspondence. I mean, how does, you know, a stove with a light? But for him, that was the symbolic meaning, just like in dreams. And it seems that spirit will communicate to us. As we had talked about earlier, we all seem to have our own set of metaphors and symbols, and spirit also speaks to us in the languages that we can understand and that we can relate to. So for some people, it might be a butterfly. Some people explained that they saw lights going on and off, and they knew it was a loved one. One person whose loved one played in a band called Smoke, after he passed or whenever he was around or she felt he was around, the smoke detector would start beeping and going off. So when we look at the language of spirit, it's a very different, it's more symbolic and also can sometimes be very paradoxical. And going back to what you said earlier, it can be whimsical. You know, it really can be.
Right. And I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh that said he was referring to roses, but we could use the metaphor of the apple. He says, you know, it's the non-apple elements in an apple that make it most truly an apple. And it's in other words, you know, it's not really an apple. It's like Magritte saying, you know, this is not a pipe, and there's a picture of a pipe. That's just the label we put on it, right? It's the mystery within it that cannot be defined as an apple. And once we understand it's a mysterious thing, it's not really an apple. But once we acknowledge that it's not an apple, it could be an apple. Sort of. It could be. Does that make sense? It can be what it is. As long as you don't get fooled by thinking that your label or your language that describes it is really the reality. It's not. It's just a a finger pointing to something, you know. And I think this is true with our life, our spiritual life, and our afterlife. You know, it's always the mystery. It's always something beyond what we can put a concept around, right? We so often, though, you know, we live our lives in concepts, you know, because that's the way we make sense of things. But that's why I like what you talk about nonsense. You know, the nonsense can be deeper, just like the fool in Shakespeare or Lewis Carroll, you know, Alice in Wonderland. The nonsense can make more sense than the sense sometimes.
Yes, and you think about koans. You know, a lot of koans, like, you know, the sound of one hand clapping, technically that's nonsense, right? That's
right.
And that's one thing that intrigued me about the language of the threshold and my invitation to listeners and to people I've worked with is just like some of us may be open to the notion of a koan, also be open to this language at end of life and if possible, not to be so afraid of it, because there is some kind of invitation again for all of us to maybe enter into new states of being and new ways of connecting with the people that we love through.
Absolutely. So folks, get a hold of this book. It's called Words at the Threshold. It's published by New World Library, one of my favorite publishers. But of course, you can get it anywhere, where in the usual outlets. And also, if you want to find out more about the Final Words Project, you can go to www.finalwordsproject.org. Find out more about Lisa and her work. It's been a real pleasure. I want to tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Lisa because we're out of time. But I hope you've enjoyed this show, and it's piqued your interest to get hold of the book. Next week, Dr. Rachel Harris joins me. She's going to talk about her new book. It's entitled Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety through the Use of That Substance, Ayahuasca. So join us then for a discussion on that. But right now, thank you so much, Lisa. It's been a wonderful show, and I've enjoyed your presence with me.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a total pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
All right, and thank you all for listening, and join us next week. All right, take care now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
What if you were intentional about your life, committed to having more energy and being more vibrant? Join Reverend Temple Hayes, spiritual leader of First Unity at Unity Campus in St. Petersburg, Florida, as she guides you on a journey to an intentional and energetic life. Empower your life and fully express the wondrous energy, love, and joy you hold in your wildest imagining. Joyfully and actively know that more important than what happens after you die is the deeper and enriching concern for what happens while you're living. How can you experience an incredible life right now? Learn how each week on The Intentional Spirit, Seeing and Being, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Central Time, right here on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
When I look at the world around me, I may feel dismayed by the amount of conflict I see. Of course I want things to be different, and perhaps I'm willing to take action. But so often I don't know exactly what to do or how. Sometimes the best place to start is with myself. By first looking at my own life and relationships, I may find areas of conflict that need to be resolved. If I want that resolution, I must work for it within myself. Peace is a personal responsibility, an ever-present power I must choose to accept. Every time I work to heal something within myself, I am helping to heal the world. Peace happens, one heart at a time. Peace can begin with me.
To find a Unity Church near you, please visit our website at www.unity.org.
Let go of everyday worries and find your calm with positive prayer from Silent Unity, the newest in voice-activated technology, available on any Alexa-enabled device like the Amazon Echo. Each prayer and meditation on positive prayer will help strengthen, guide, and comfort you. To enable it, just say, "Alexa, open positive prayer." You can ask for a specific prayer on topics like healing, prosperity, and comfort. Give it a try today.